We sit in hipster bars and discuss
if we're poetic enough.
We pet our neuroses till they curl up.
3, 2, 1. Happy birthday, Merry Christmas, and Good Resurrection Day. This is Ashley Maritson.
This is Sarah Willey Hill.
We are
Demons
and
Dames.
And today I'm going to be telling a story, aren't I, Cesar?
Maybe.
Do you mind if I call you that, Cesar?
Only my fairy step-godmother is allowed to call me... Oh, she calls me Saz. That's even worse.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm going to stick with Cesar. Right, today we are going to be talking about Madeleine Smith.
Well, that's quite an interesting name. Is she Irish?
No, she's not. She's a Scottish woman, a Scots woman. A Scot. She's in fact Glaswegian, and she was born on the 29th of March, 1835. So am I to take it you have never heard of her?
I think she might be a poisoner.
Now, are you just saying that because you know I love a poisoner?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Yeah, well, you're right, she is. But really, you don't know anything else about her?
You just said she was from Glasgow.
Yes.
She was born in 18...
Okay, this doesn't count, but you're right. All those things are true that I just said.
She was born in 1830-something.
1835, to be precise.
Okay, 1835. So she's living under Queen Victoria.
Quite right, too.
And she's a poisoner.
Okay, great. So Sarah knows nothing about Madeleine Smith. Happily, I know more than is good for me and soon to be all of you.
Well, I am really excited because Lord knows I love poisoner.
Yes, well, we do. Domestic terrorists!
Yes!
Taking the manacles by which they've been chained and throwing them back in the face of the oppressor. Sorry, that's just my personal take. So Madeleine Smith was born on 29th of March, 1835. The first child of five to an upper middle class
What does
family.
Upper middle class in the 1830s mean?
Oh, Sarah, I was hoping you would ask. The middle classes are very much a 19th century creation. They're product of the Industrial Revolution. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, you've got the rich and you've got the poor. But thanks to the... why does the Industrial Revolution cause creation of the middle class?
Well, I think... God, you really put me on the spot, goddamn you. So basically it's Marx, right? So it's the
And Marx?
Marx and Sparks. Well, I mean, like,
British
eventually...
British joke.
Yeah. You've basically got... The means of production is expanding. So...
Yes.
It no longer takes a craftsman, say, you know, 5 days to knit a single lace doily. It can be done by machine.
Mm-hmm.
So lace doilies become more affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Workers start working in factory. They start getting a wage. They have access to capital in a way that they wouldn't if they were, say, farming.
Mm-hmm.
And it means their purchasing power increases at the same time that goods are becoming cheaper.
Thanks, Sarah. That was really helpful. But could you please try and remember in future that this is my episode? Well, the other key... Now, this is something I do know a bit more about. I just go to pieces when I start thinking about economics. What I do know an awful lot about is morality. And the trappings of. So this new class has to come up with a way of defining themselves. A way of defining themselves that extends beyond densely patterned wallpapers and overly stuffed living rooms, though those are an important feature too. And what they come up with is a strict moral code, in many ways mimicking that of the ideal family as epitomised by Queen Victoria. Although,
ooh.
Oh yeah, very much true. Kind of like Monica is also a middle class heroine, you know. Actual aristocrats were perceived as being kind of dissolute, untrustworthy types.
So the only thing I know about Queen Victoria in the middle class is that she's the reason we wear white wedding gowns.
And black for funerals.
Really?
Well beyond. Yeah.
Queen Victoria, fashion icon.
Binary type. The yin and the yang of the Victorian wardrobe.
Wow.
The middle classes have very strict social rules. It's what makes them better than the working class.
Goodness.
And, you know, it's important. It's important to be better than the working class.
Is the morality code intrinsically part of kind of the religious beliefs? Or is it kind of above and beyond that?
I'd say being seen to be religious is more important than being religious. It's about appearances, the keeping up of said appearances.
Oh, goodness.
It's about the maintenance of one's reputation. And, of course, for whom is a reputation most important? But for women.
Women.
Because God knows they've not got anything else.
Yeah.
Well, they got lots of skirts. In the 1850s, in fact, when the action of this is about to go down, yo, women have just been blessed by the invention of the hooped skirt. In the 1840s, they were just wearing lots and lots of petticoats to achieve that silhouette. So many petticoats, in fact, that a woman tried to kill herself by jumping off Vauxhall Bridge of Sighs in the 1840s and just parachuted down. But I
digress.
I digress. Of course, they'll put her in the madhouse immediately afterwards. And then she really will have wished she was dead. Madeleine Smith was born into an upper middle class family. At the bottom of the middle classes, you've got the clerks, maybe making like £1 a week. At the top of it, you've got the architects, you've got the lawyers, you've got men who have a profession.
Mm-hmm.
Madeleine's parents are James Smith. He's a successful architect, and her mother is Elizabeth. She is the daughter of another architect, neoclassical practitioner David Hamilton.
Keeping it in the profession?
Keeping it in the family. It's nice, yes, but not actually in the family, I don't think. And as I said, they're in Glasgow, which is the secondary city in Scotland, but it's very much an industrial-fueled one. It's very much a Victorian metropolis.
Would Glasgow have been quite prosperous at this period of time?
Immensely so. It had many industries, none of which I can name, but I definitely saw a long list of them at some point.
Okay.
Madeleine has been raised for great things. By which I mean, she's been raised for a great marriage.
Oh, goodness.
By the standards of the time. She has been educated in England, no less.
What would a woman's education have consisted of? I assume more than just sewing.
French.
Okay.
Dancing. Embroidery, which is a form of sewing.
The art of conversation.
The art of conversation. Her school was called Mrs. Gorton's Academy for Young Ladies. I think it would equip you with all the skills you needed to make a delightful hostess. You know, some arithmetic to help with your household management. There would, of course, be musical education. You know, no one wants a girl who can't read. You know, she'd be well equipped to peruse some of the sort of ladies' literature of the day, unlikely to be able to discourse on Pliny, the sort of more masculine studies.
Pliny the Elder or Pliny the Younger?
Pliny, fuck off. Pliny, suck my dick. She would have had an adequate education for the time, for her purpose, which, as I said, would be to marry a great man. Later in our tale, if I ever stop bloody telling it, she will be betrothed to the ideal partner for the time.
Is he an architect?
No, it's weird, isn't it?
Oh, he's not an architect.
I guess she was related to all the architects in Glasgow.
She got bored.
but she would write to him in a letter. She'll write to this gentleman, William Minnick. My aim in life shall be to please you and to study you.
Oh, goodness.
And that's the aim she's been allocated from the start. Poor William Minnick didn't stand a chance. When she comes back to Glasgow, having been educated in London in the early 1850s, she's in her late teens, and she becomes very quickly the reigning belle. Mm-hmm. You know, her days consist of social calls with her mother, a little bit of light embroidery, and then up to 5 dances a night.
Did she have, like, lovely little lace-painted calling cards she would leave at her friends' houses when she came to call?
Well, I don't know. How else would they know she'd been there?
I know.
I like to think she most certainly did. She was not keen on Glasgow, but given how much she went out, she was certainly keen on a party. One of the reasons she was so successful was because she looked quite a lot like Queen Victoria, which at the time was considered a
really
good thing.
Really beautiful.
Well, you know, if you like them small, plump and dark. Everything so far so conventional. Madeleine's life mapped out for her. But everything is about to change. And that day of change is fittingly Valentine's Day, 1855. Madeleine receives a single red rose.
Ooh.
And the sender is a gentleman called Pierre-Émile Langelier.
French-ish.
He's from Jersey in the Channel Islands. And he has seen her oot in a boot, as we say up north, on the well-known promenade. I initially thought it was called Saucy Hill Street. Alas, on closer reading, it's actually called Saucy Hill Street. But still, it's fabulous. He's seen her out and about with her sister Bessie. He sent her this rose, and a few weeks later, he manages to engineer an introduction.
Okay, so he's from Jersey.
Yeah.
He's in Glasgow for work.
Yeah.
Is he of her social class? Is he...
Well, other than the fact that he's a stinky, almost Frenchman, he also has the misfortune to be a pretty low-ranking clerk in a seedsman's office, presumably a purveyor of seeds. His father was a French nurseryman.
Okay.
I'm assuming that's not like a babysitter.
No, so I'm assuming like small plants we're talking about.
That sounds more plausible. Yeah. And he left France during the Revolution of 1830. Like Madeleine, Pierre-Émile Langelier, who we shall henceforth call Émile, because that's what she called him, is the eldest of five.
So they have that in common.
That's nice, isn't it? Yeah. And he's, and as we'll find out, they're both incurable romantics. Aww. He's notably dandified in his dress. He wears a fine twirling moustache. I've never actually seen a man twirl a moustache. Émile is very proud of his small feet.
He probably hasn't heard the old adage about small feet, has he?
Guess that came later. He can play the guitar, and he's a little on the plump side.
So, do you think he has kind of class aspirations?
He very well observed. So, other than the fact he spends the vast majority of his meagre income, £50 a year, on clothes, he also claims aristocratic descent.
Right, you know, he is a dandy.
To be fair...
Dandy wannabe.
It's easy when you got a slightly foreign accent, like when I go to the US. I've been known to claim aristocratic descent.
But I would have believed you had you told me that when I lived in the US.
Yeah, it's not just in the US that happens. He's a... he's 10 years older than Madeleine, and suffice to say, he's quite the romantic figure.
So he's basically just seen her in the street and been like, I want me some of that. I'm going to send her a rose on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
And then... engineer an introduction. How does one do that?
A mutual acquaintance reluctantly roped in. I mean, how does one do that? Oh, come on, like, you've never done that.
I mean, like, isn't that what Tinder is for?
Yes, well, this is what... This whole story, this is what happens when you don't have Tinder. I'm about to tell you about how the romance between Madeleine and Émile unfolds. And we know... quite a lot about it, and that's because they were sent each other a lot of letters.
Ooh, do we still have these letters?
Most certainly we do, and I'll tell you something sensational. A historian who was looking into Madeleine in the 1970s looked at the letters themselves, and they still smelt of musk. Musk is one of the most prominent, you know, ingredients in ladies' scent in the period, and it's activated by heat. So when he handled them, he was actually able to smell Madeleine's scent.
That is beautiful.
What a scent it would be. The letters are almost entirely those written by her, because Madeleine, being a young lady with some presence of mind, destroyed Émile's. We have a few of
his. That's kind of weird. So it's a very one-sided account of their romance.
It is. It is a very one-sided account. She did, however, return some of his to him for... safekeeping, one assumes. We have got some of his. We have got some of what he wrote. There are over 198 letters found in Émile's lodging after he...
Wait, 198, and these are mostly all just from her?
Yeah.
What time period are we talking about here?
2 years. Oh, come on, baby. Think how many text messages you send.
Oh, God, yeah, but, like, letters. Like, that's got to be at least, like, 2 pages each, you know?
The alternative is embroidery.
Oh, God, yeah, fair enough. Bring on the letter 60 writing.
60 of these would be read at her tile. Another little detail about these letters that I love is that Émile's landlady saw that he was receiving a lot of letters, and they were inscribed in such a dashing style that she assumed they were from a man.
Ooh. Yeah.
Beginning April 1855, Madeleine writes her first letter, and it's right in at the deep end. My dear Émile, I do not feel as if I were writing you for the first time. Though our intercourse, not in a sexy way, has been very short, definitely not in a sexy way, yet we have become as familiar friends. May we long continue so, and ere lang may you be a friend of Papa's, is my most earnest desire.
So she's like, I dig you, let me introduce you to my father.
That's a Victorian... Yeah, I know. Funnily enough, if you said that now, it would have a very different set of meanings, but back then it meant you're, yeah, I'm into it. She's, you know, this is a very typical Victorian romantic script. You know, she casts herself as a kind of penitent seeking personal betterment, you know, in order to be more deserving of him, you know. I am trying to break myself off of all my very bad habits. It is you I have to thank for this. I wish I understood botany for your sake, as I might send you some specimens of moss. And in typical Victorian style, she even includes a nasty little poem. I never cast a flower away, the gift of one who cared for me. A little flower, a faded flower, but it was done reluctantly. Gross. So far... Sorry, Madeline, that was lovely. Did you write it? Did you write that yourself? So far, so conventional in terms of means of expression. What makes this less so is the fact that she's writing this letter to this man, unendorsed by her family, on the sly. The fact she's running at all. And they're not easy to deliver. Suffice to say, when her father finds out about this burgeoning romance, she's ratted out by her sister, Bessie.
Of course she is. Oh, Younger sisters are the worst.
Like, honestly, though, this Madeleine, as we go on, I think she is the worst older sister, at least. Like, you know, the two younger sisters, neither of whom will ever marry. One imagines if it's something to do with what Madeleine's going to do for the family name further down the line. Mm. But they're very much... Bessie seems to be the sort of unlovely, jealous second one. And then Janet, who Madeleine shares a room with, she frequently refers to as stupid Janet.
Goodness.
Yeah, and she's only 12, bless her.
I bet Bessie regrets this later, since she probably... her actions of ratting out her sister might eventually lead to her unmarried state.
Yeah, well, that's why... Yeah. That's why you shouldn't tell tales.
I mean, we're assuming that an unmarried state at this time is really undesirable because it means you're tied to your parents forever.
Yeah, one assumes as much.
Which is the only thing worse I can imagine worse than getting married.
Maybe she was teaching art in Kent. Maybe it was nice.
That would be lovely.
But Mr. Smith is furious. Mrs. Smith takes to her bed in this. It's never recorded that she gets out of it. She certainly takes to it an awful lot. And that's another sort of interesting part of the sort of Smith family dynamic. Like, Madeleine very much runs the house. Her mother seems to be something of a hypochondriac. You know, she's got all the vapours that one might associate with a hypochondriac of that period.
I wonder if
this is her female role model.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering if there's some sort of dynamic there between hypochondria and poisoning. And this idea of, like...
Munchausen syndrome.
Maybe a little bit, yeah.
I just want to say that. Munchausen syndrome. And on we go. Madeleine stops this correspondence after her first intervention by her father, but then quickly that she starts actually meeting L'Angelier in person. He hangs around outside her house and occasionally gets to chill out with her in the laundry. Later assignments take place at the home of an elderly maiden lady who goes to church with Emile. What?
Okay, so Emile is hanging out with her in the laundry.
Yeah, man. Smells like sheets. Nice.
That's weirdly erotic, yeah.
Yeah, I do really love clean sheets.
Yeah, totally.
You know what? I don't need a man to hang out in laundry.
You can just do it all by yourself.
That's what I'm saying. So, again, Mr. Smith finds out. Again, he tries to stop. Now, I want to zoom in on a letter from this period, the second paternal intervention, because I'm really taken with how Madeleine expresses herself. Like, Madeleine's very... invested in this, in notions of destiny, of fate, and increasingly imminent doom. She really embraces the powerlessness of herself as a female, you know, positioning herself as a kind of ornamental pawn. After her father has intervened for the second time, she sends a letter to Miss Perry, who is the elderly maiden lady where she has her, who hosts her assignations with Emile. And she says to her, "My papa would not give his consent, so I'm duty-bound to obey him. I have a father to please, and a kind father too." Emile's response to this, because we have his letter, is interesting that it responds in kind, once similarly positioning Madeleine as a kind of pawn in this sort of, like, dynamic, this dialogue, this territorial battle between two men. "You have deceived your father as you have deceived me. You never told him how solemnly you bound yourself to me. Or, if you had, for the honour of his daughter, he could not have asked to break off an engagement as yours." Anyway, if you're anything like me, when you hear Emile speak like that, you think, what do you think?
I think, what a dick.
What a dick! Emil is a Victorian man. Stern, uncompromising, high moral character.
Pudgy and a good dresser.
Everything you want. He's a man of principle. And he loves to lecture Madeline. And actually, one can't help but wonder if Madeline kind of enjoys it.
I assume she would have been conditioned from an early age to, you know, respond to this kind of authoritarian male figure.
Madeline, you have truly acted wrong. May this be a lesson to you never to trifle with anyone again. Yeah, you like that, don't you?
Ooh. My skin crawls.
Now, fast forward. That's my fast forward sound. To the spring of 1856. A year has passed, and things are reaching something of a passionate crescendo.
Is this going to involve some literal climaxing?
Yes.
Yay! I mean, he sounds like a dick, but
we're getting there. We're just crescendoing right now, okay? Madeline is on holiday. Nice. She's at the family country house at the Rue. You know, it's embarrassing that I'm Scottish and I'm reading all of her in I can't do anything resembling an accent. But anyway, they're at a country house on the Rue, on the Garry Lock. Please don't put that out there. I don't want my Scottish friends to hate me. but anyway, it's a popular area for summer houses amongst the well-to-do. Emil was coming out to visit her fairly regularly. After one visit, she writes to him, "My own darling husband." And it's interesting that she's essentially made, to her mind, they are married.
Okay.
Because they love each other and because that creates a certain permission to go beyond.
This is really interesting because I think this comes back to the thing about the middle classes being concerned about not the religious aspects of morality, but the kind of the practical and social aspects.
I love what you're saying. I think that is so, so true. That is so true. And throughout the letters that they exchange, you know, there's this idea that they will be married. They will be married, even though Madeline, and I imagine he knows on some level, will probably never happen. By creating that kind of fantasy, it gives them permission to behave in ways that two single people would not. She writes to him, "My own darling husband, I did not expect the pleasure of seeing you last evening, of being fondled by you, dear, dear Emil." I don't know if I love the notion of fondling. Anyway, she signs off, "much, much love, kisses, tender, long embraces, kisses, love." God, don't you just long for emojis? "I'm thy own, nauseating. Thy ever fond, thy own dear loving wife, thy Mimi Langelier." She always calls herself Mimi, and notice she takes a surname. June 1856. I call this section "Sex in the Garden at Rue." "Beloved, if we did wrong last night, it was in the excitement of our love. Yes, beloved, I did truly love you with my soul. I was happy. It was a pleasure to be with you." And then, in case we weren't entirely clear from this letter what just happened, she said, "I did not bleed in the least last night, but I had a good deal of pain during the night." This is nuts. Who has ever heard or read anything written by a woman in the 19th century talking about post-
I'm sorry.
Virginity loss.
Can you just
bleeding?
Imagine texting that to your boyfriend after losing your virginity in the morning?
Darling, text messaging did not exist when I lost my virginity. This sexual episode inevitably is highly transgressive. This is, you know, this is...
It's not normal for kind of middle class Glaswegian women to be going around sleeping with whomever they fancy.
Darling, it's not even normal for middle class women from Birmingham. Or Hull. The working classes were a fairly loose bunch. You know, there was a fair amount of bed hopping. It was a lot less prescriptive. Yeah.
I didn't actually know that.
No, that was very much the case. That's one of the reasons that and to a certain extent the upper classes, there was a kind of understanding that, you know, people had affairs, but so long as the form was observed, and was permissible. The middle classes genuinely observed their own strict rules. This would have been absolutely unheard of. And it's amazing that she was able to make it happen. I mean, when she first meets Emil, she would have been out with Bessie. You know, you're virtually always chaperoned. To be able to spend time alone with a man who's not been endorsed by your parents is extremely difficult. And the logistics of getting him to this summer house, he's sending her newspapers on certain days, and the fact of the newspaper being sent shows her that he'll be there the next day. So that's a kind of code embedded in that. He's got to take a boat. If her father's on the boat, he's got to get off at an earlier port and then walk across a bloody mountain. She's blackmailing her maid into giving him admission because her maid has got a lover. And although she's not middle class and it wouldn't lead to her loss of reputation in the same way, she's employed by the middle classes and therefore would lose her position if she were to be exposed. So it's shocking.
The logistics of what people will do to get laid never ceases to amaze me.
I literally won't go to another postcode. Needless to say, given the stigma surrounding this, this isn't, you know, this lovemaking, the post-coital moment, alas, is not a rosy, smoke-filled one for her and Emil. It's one filled with reproach and self-recrimination, particularly on the part of Mimi, or Madeleine.
Is she slut-shaming herself?
Yes. The woman is the guardian of morality. Men, as we know, are lusty, fallen creatures, and it's down to us to keep our legs closed.
Goodness.
Didn't you know that, love? Oh my God, let me tell you a thing or two. She writes to Emil, "You must be disappointed with me. I wonder if you like me in the least. Tell me, pet, were you angry at me for allowing you to do what you did? Was it very bad of me?"
Is she not just being, like, super passive-aggressive here? And she actually means, like, I cannot believe that you've done this to me. Or do you think these are, like, genuine self-recriminations?
If she is trying to do that, Emil is not taking the bait. Because he responds very much in kind. "I'm sad at what we did. Ouchies. What we did, I regret it very much. Why, Mimi, did you give way after your promises?"
Wait. So she's promised to marry him?
No, she promised not to have sex with him until they were married. And she's relented.
And now he's giving a shit about it.
Yes.
I'm just gonna come out and say I think he had it coming.
He had it coming.
I'm making some assumptions and jumping ahead in the story here, but Jesus Christ.
You know, it's challenging because I understand that Emil is a product of his age. Certainly, if a man held these views today, he would have it coming.
I feel like a lot of men today probably do.
He's towing the line, you know, If he had it coming, so did all of them.
But also it feels like it's very much a power play. So he's using these kind of recriminations and things to have power over her.
There's a lot of, you know, there's mixed views on this. You know, some people think, would call Emil more sinned against than sinning. Like, he does seem to genuinely love her. But he also simultaneously holds the views of the time. She's a bit too transgressive for him. He can't handle her. "I was not angry at your allowing me, Mimi, but I am sad it happened. You have no resolution." This tone, this is very much his go-to tone from talking to Mimi, as he would call her, you know. There's lots about him. He compels her constantly to improve herself. "You are not stupid, Mimi," he says. You know, when someone says to me, "You are not stupid, Ashley," I feel like they think I'm stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise I just don't know if that needs to be said.
No, it really doesn't.
He's tormented by the fact that she's going out to balls all the time, that she's gossiped about, that she's known to be a flirt. I mean, in many ways, yeah, he's...
Is he also feeling like maybe quite, like, she did this with me, what's to stop her doing this with other people?
He's in an unusual position for a man at the time because he has no power in this, you know. In a sense, he's the mistress, you know, he's the one forced to live in the shadows, yet he's trying to make a power play, you know, he's trying to sort of curtail the way she acts. I mean, if she's not under his control, but he would desperately like her to be.
Interesting.
Now, I mentioned earlier a man called William Minnick, a name, alas, that belongs in an entirely different...
Minnick, the not architect.
Yeah, William Minnick. He's a partner in a trading firm. I mean, they belong to very different schools of literature. The Emile Lingeries of the world. And the William Minnocks. You know, this is the kind of person your mid-19th century parents produce as a prospective lover. And so they do in June 1856. Not long after Mimi failed in her resolution.
Is deflowered in the flower garden.
Oh, boom! I love that. Not long since he rooted her amongst the roots.
Ooh.
Madeleine's parents are so into William that they actually move house to fashionable number 7 Blythewood Square. This house looks a lot more impressive than it was. It looks like it's got 4 floors. They've actually only got the bottom 2. And guess who's got number 3? Mr. Minnock. Round about this time, Madeleine's communications with Emile start to blow somewhat.
So her parents like this guy so much, they basically move into the same building as him.
Yeah.
So that the daughter's gonna get it on? I don't know.
No, what's the... No. That's, again,
it just
Victorian
seems
parents. They
I know, that's
genuinely
what seems
will not
weird.
Be encouraging, because they know that if he were to have amorous congress, as we shall henceforward call it, with her before marriage, you would consider her a fallen woman, and, you know, that would be...
Okay.
As it is, she's going to have to...
So doesn't it seem, like, quite risky to them, to, like, you know...
I think there's this assumption that the sort of, like, boundaries around kind of, you know, that the rules around social behaviour are sufficiently strong that they don't need to be propped up. I think also because he's a respectable man, there's a sense that they can trust him too. And also, like, oh, whoa, I mean, man, this guy, he's... He's a partner in a trading firm. He's quite a bit older. He's produced by her parents. I don't think they're, you know, worried about the sort of sexual chemistry between him and Madeleine overriding decorum.
That is so depressing.
Yeah, I know.
It does not bode well for their marriage.
That's all right, it's never going to happen. she starts blowing a bit hard and cold towards Emile at this point because, well...
Because he's being a bit of a dick?
Well, it's funny, actually. She says, quite frankly, at one point later on, she describes... She knows it's unsustainable. Really, there's no future for them. They talk about getting married. They set some dates. She says, oh, I'm going to learn to economise so I can keep a furnished room for us. But although she may certainly have loved him or lusted for him, ultimately, she's a survivor and... Mm-hmm. Her father will never accept him. I mean, that's been made fairly clear by the way he's responded the couple of times he's had an intimation that there's something going on.
Mm-hmm.
As it is, you know, we've seen Emile is quite an overbearing sort. I think it was a bit of fun. It was a bit of flirtation because she is one hell of a woman. She took it rather far.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was what that was. And, you know, there are attractions to the marriage that's been set before her. You know, it's a place in society. It's continuing to hold her sort of
she likes the parties, she likes the balls, she likes going out.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea of sort of like a secret romance with a man of lower station, obviously that would appeal to the sort of teenage girl in her, but the pragmatist
wants the power and wants the social acceptance.
Absolutely. And I don't think we should judge her for that. Well, just because Emile's such a dick, isn't he?
Yeah.
So she starts saying things to him, and this is classic. This is like how a 19th century woman says, it's not you, it's me. I sometimes fancy you are disappointed with me. I'm not what you once thought I was. I'm too much of a child. I'm too fond of amusement. She says to him, I think that I should avoid you so that everyone thinks I've lost interest in you. She says... The weird thing is, I just kind of become indifferent eventually to the things I love.
Ooh, that's quite cutting.
That said, at the same time as she's becoming a little, starting to blow somewhat colder in her written word, she's actually continuing to meet him. She's got a basement bedroom. What? Say what? She does. Near the kitchen, because they have the bottom 2 floors. Now, in this period... The norm would have been for servants to sleep in the basement bedroom for precisely the reason we're about to find out. But because the Smiths, like so many members of the middle class, are more concerned with the appearance of propriety than actual propriety, they just put her down there and figure no one will know about it. Big mistake. He's always swinging by, bribes the local constable with cigars, they have a chat, and she mixes him some cocoa in the kitchen next door.
Aww, that's quite nice.
On January the 28th, 1857, Madeleine accepts William Minnock's offer. Does she tell Emil? Oh no, she don't. She just sends him increasingly short and cool letters and drops reference to a dark spot in the future. One day, so lacking in love is the letter she sends him that he returns it. And she takes that as an opportunity to make a definite break. She gives instructions, very important instructions, about how he is to return the letters she has sent him. Because that's good form, right? You know, yeah. I've seen enough Peter Adams. I know that's how it works. You know, no one's ever written me a letter, but I think if they did, I might return it.
You know, you'd be afraid of the blackmail, right? Because it's like he has all this incriminating evidence against her.
And so she is right to be afraid of the blackmail because, of course, he does not turn up for the appointment. She suggests another one.
Nor
does he turn up to that. Eventually, he sends her a letter saying that he regards her as his wife and he will show her letters to her father.
What does he actually expect to get out of this?
I think he expects to marry her. I think that if he doesn't love her, and I think he certainly did, it's at the very least become a point of principle. He's very emphatic about the fact that she is his wife. And he is, unlike Madeleine, religious. And I think genuinely religious.
Okay. But what about the money as well? Is this kind of him trying to climb the social ladder?
Well, marrying that's up? What many would accuse him of, and that's why, as we'll soon, that will very much be the popular attitude. It's not something he ever mentions. I don't know. I mean, I think that you're being a bit of a Victorian by assuming that a working class man can only love a middle class woman for her money. You know,
it's not just that. It's also the fact that, knowing that she's kind of gone off him, as it were, he doesn't relinquish his feelings in any way.
Yes, well, she's his property now, isn't she?
Ooh.
And he has, over the course of their courtship, proposed various ways of getting himself rich quick. He talked about going to Lima to find his fortune. You know, he's aware of the obstacles and he seems willing to address them himself. Again, there's no mention at any point of the payout that might ensue. I mean, I think there's an assumption that she'll probably be cut off.
Okay.
Should she marry him. Now, her response to this threat is so raw, so genuinely distraught sounding, it's hard not to feel for her. She says, "Emil, for God's sake, do not send my letters to Papa. It will be an open rupture. I will leave the house. I will die. On my bended knees, I write to you and ask you, as you hope for mercy at the judgment, do not inform on me. Do not make me a public shame."
She sounds so trapped.
I mean, because this is what will happen, and that's it. She is trapped. She could marry him. But, I mean, the fact that his relentlessness, his sense of his will, his right, his implacability, he's not a bad man, but he's a rather horrifying one.
I think the idea of being blackmailed into getting married to someone, it just sounds horrific.
Yeah, no, it's... So as soon as she arranges to meet him, and they do, and they have a great reconciliation. So far, so good. That's 11th of February. On the 19th of February, Madeleine goes with Minuk to see Donizetti's Lucrezia Borgia, a famous Renaissance poisoness. I made that word up, I'm going to use it. Mm-hmm. After that, she meets L'Angelier at a basement gaff window. She gives him some cocoa. They have a little chat. That night, he goes home and he suffers violent pain in his bowels and his stomach.
Is it
landlady
his conscience?
Finds him. Darling, everyone knows your conscience is in your elbow. he says to people afterwards, because he doesn't die, he says, "I can't think why I was so unwell after getting that coffee and chocolate from her. It is a perfect fascination, my attachment to that girl. If she were to poison me, I would forgive her." It's a lot that's very confusing about this. Again, that sounds like a man who loves her very much.
Or it sounds like a man that's about to frame someone for poisoning
her. Oh, you got there! You're so... God, nefarious. You're nefarious little mind, you.
I admit.
I can tell you've framed someone for... You've framed a couple of people in your time. 3 days later,
definitely
he will have
thought about
a...
It. No names.
3 days later, he will have meet her again and have a second gastric attack. After that, she sends him a letter basically saying, oh, something must be going around. She says, oh, everyone is complaining. It must be something in the air.
Aww. The vapours, darling. The vapours.
The vapours. Must have caught them from her mother.
Okay, so where is he writing about the poisoning? Is it in a diary?
These are first-person accounts. These are the things he said to people.
So he's actually going around telling people that she's poisoned him. That's suspicious as fuck.
Well, he's saying that, no, I mean, he doesn't say in so many ways. He says that, yes. On the 12th of March, her wedding date is set.
Aww.
On the 21st of March, she meets Langelier. On the 23rd of March, he dead. Things go south fairly quickly. Her letters are found, sort of, in someone from the French consulate, because he is Frenchish, goes and tells her father. Her mother takes to her bed. Her father takes to his bed.
I take it.
There's rumours of an autopsy. Madeline takes to the countryside. They dig him, exhume him. They perform an autopsy and they find enough arsenic in his body to kill 40 men.
Jesus, that's a lot of arsenic. Where would arsenic have been available at this point of time?
Word. That is such a well-timed question, Sarah, because I'm about to tell you, my friend, about the poison panic.
Ooh.
Jazz hands. But before I do that, I'm going to let you know that Madeline denied everything, said she hadn't seen Langelier for 3 weeks, and yeah, no one believed her.
Mm.
She goes on trial in May in Edinburgh because the Glaswegians are considered a wee bit too sympathetic.
To her or to him?
To her, obviously, babe. She's a middle-class woman. So you asked me about arsenic, Sarah.
I did. And how does one get arsenic?
Your arsenic in the 19th century was blooming everywhere. Like rats in London now. And probably rats in London then.
Yeah.
Arsenic was colourless. It was odourless. And it was cheap. You found it in paints, you found it in dyes, you found it in soaps, in patent medicines. You used it for pest control, you used it for fertilizer, weed killer. In stables as a wash for horses' coats, on farms as sheep dip. It killed rats in the home, and it killed pimples on your face. Complexion enhancement. That was a big arsenic sort of like
so
commercial
it's like
avenue.
The cure-all.
Yeah.
It's in makeup, it's in,
it's
you
the
know.
Cranberries. It's it's the goji berries of the mid-19th century.
Wow.
In fact, I love this. I found this advert for Dr. McKenzie's arsenical toilet soap. This is the text. Will produce the most lovely complexion, free from blotch, blemish, coarseness, redness, freckles, pimples, lines, wrinkles, or crow's feet. Like, literally, women have been wearing for about exactly the same thing for over 100 years.
And they were literally putting poison on their skin to make their complexions
yeah.
better.
I don't know what I'm putting on my skin now, but I'm sure that people will be worrying about it a few years down the road.
So it's easy to get her hands
it's
on.
It's very easy to get its hand on. And it's
but it's well known as a poison if you take too much.
It is. Now, so in the 1840s, there's a media confected hysteria around poison.
Well, you know I love a good hysteria.
Oh, you... I don't know what to say that. It's just so fabulous and so true. had been a lot of well-documented cases of working-class women poisoning their family members. Not just poisoning their family members, also talk of poison rings. So these would have been women poisoning people for their life insurance. You might poison someone else's husband in exchange for him poisoning yours. Like,
so this is like a working class thing, you said.
It's very much a working class thing. Or at least it has been. Not long before Madeline Smith finds herself in the dock, there have been a couple of really high profile middle class poisoners. Medical men. Now, what's scarier than a doctor with a bottle of arsenic?
Wow. Maybe they were just shit doctors. Did anyone consider that?
Highly probable in the 19th century, all right. But the Times wrote about this. The friendly arsenic has always been ready in the cottage of the peasant or in the lodging of the mechanic. So when it was announced that in a higher rank of life a similar crime had been committed, there was interest and excitement, but without surprise.
So they're literally, once again, demonising women. by showing them as poisoners.
Well, there's, and I'd like to talk in a mini-sode, actually, about a maidservant from the 1815, I think, so it's quite a bit earlier. Her name was Eliza Fanning, who was executed because she was convicted of poisoning the family she worked for. It's very obvious that there was no arsenic involved in what happened there. Well, but what could be more frightening than a woman given a weapon, and a weapon that is administered exclusively by those with whom we're intimate? It's the kind of domestic devil, isn't it? As a result of this, and again, I want to emphasise, this was a confection. In the mid-19th century, only 2 years, cases a year, were convicted of poisoning.
So,
but as a result, in 1851, they enforced the Sale of Arsenic Act.
Okay.
So if you're only over those over 21 who are known to the chemist or vouched for by someone who was, can buy arsenic. Their names and addresses are recorded. They must sign for it. They must have a witness to their signature. And a lot of arsenic is dyed using indigo and soot.
So how did Madeline get her hands on arsenic then?
Well, she only bloody signed for it. They knew she'd bought it. There were three instances of her buying arsenic.
I feel like this is a frame up. I'm sorry. She can't be that stupid.
No. She went in saying she wanted to buy it for some rats, and then she wanted to buy some to send for the guard to the gardener. And there was a lot that was disingenuous. She was asking questions like, so, how much would it take to poison a human being? And she deliberately purchased from two different chemists. She bought them for she bought it to kill rats in the house in Glasgow. There were no rats. There were no rats in the house in Glasgow. Madeline, right. I like to think she's a smart bird, but there's certainly a real sense of complacency around her ability to get away with this. A sense of complacency that will be proven entirely justified.
Okay, I actually, until this point, thought it might be a frame-up because he just sounds like such a slippery character, but that seems pretty definite.
Well, again, you're buying... You won't be the only one who thinks he sounds slippy, because she is going to get away with it. From the very beginning, there's a real reluctance around covering this event. The middle-class murderer is a lot more frightening to the middle classes than the working class one. Understandably.
And who's writing the news?
Well, these rags, well, they wouldn't like to be called rags, broadsheets, are certainly being written by and for the middle classes. Initially, it's covered far more discreetly, this murder, than is common. The Glasgow Herald headline is, "A painful event."
Oh, goodness.
There's a sense that this behaviour embarrasses the middle classes collectively. "We fervently trust that the cloud which at present obscures a most respectable and estimable household may be speedily and effectively removed." Billy Minnick says at the outset of the trial that he will most certainly be marrying Madeline afterwards.
Wait, so he actually stands by her?
Oh, yeah, he do. Her parents, incidentally, aren't there for any of the trial. They're a trial. They've taken to their beds. The only family member who's there is poor old 13-year-old Janet, who's forced
stupid
to testify.
Janet.
Aww. Now, Madeline is gloriously confident in court. I can't decide if she knows she's going to be fine or if she's outright loving it. There's this London edition of the trial, and it describes her as such. "Madeline Smith, a very young lady of short stature and slight form, with restless and sparkling eye, stepped up the stair into the dock with all the buoyancy with which she might have entered the box of a theatre. Her perfect self-possession, indeed, could only be accounted for by either a proud consciousness of innocence or by almost unparalleled amount of self-control. She even sometimes smiled with all the air and grace of a young lady in the drawing room."
Mm.
And I can tell you exactly what she's wearing.
Please.
From our fashion correspondent at the trial of Madeline Smith, she's dressed simply, but elegantly. Brown silk dress, black silk cloak, small fashionable bonnet with white ribbon trim, lavender-coloured gloves, nice touch, and a small silver-top smelling bottle. And she's constantly described as being this kind of unmoved and cool sort of like personage around which the sort of mania of the trial orbits. And it's important that she looks respectable, because that, in itself, is an assurance of virtue.
Is she also acting in a way that would be respectable for a lady in this position?
Well, her activities in prison, she's described as spending her time in prison in light reading, with the occasional regret at the want of a piano,
Right.
And the Daily News says her demeanour is certainly not that of a guilty person. Well, she's clearly not guilty, is she? Like, you know, that's how that works. And the Times says that, you know, her possession of arsenic was compatible with entire innocence. If you were a maid and you had arsenic in your property and, you know, in your box and your mistress had a bad bowel movement, you're going to get hung for it.
So this is very much an unfair class advantage that she is riding on.
There's a sense that the middle class is... the reason so many maid servants are charged and found guilty is there's a sense that the word of a middle class person carries much more weight than that of someone from the lower classes. They have to be believed. This is, again, this is middle class morality bolstering middle class morality. This is everyone's got a vested interest in Madeline being found not guilty.
So what is the story that she's telling then?
She's a little vague. She says there was an understanding they would be married. There's no talk of canoodling, needless to say, but that they'd called it off and she'd become engaged to someone else and she hadn't seen him for 3 weeks before he died.
So what about the letter in which she describes the deflowering in the garden?
Her immaculate composure is going to be somewhat ruffled come the reading of the letters. They are read in court. They're not read in their entirety. And interestingly, Langelier's diary is not admitted in evidence. Massive fail on the part of the prosecution. But parts of the letters are read. Gross and indelicate allusions and particular words are censored. They're considered to be so appalling that they don't feel comfortable reading all of them.
The judge
is particularly shocked by the underlining of the word love 3 times in one particular letter, where she says, "For I know you will like to love," underline, 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 your Mimi. The prosecution wins this element of the trial, like her reputation. It is ruined. And she becomes something of a folk hero amongst the more rakish, you know, sort of members of, you know...
For having premarital sex or for poisoning her lover. So 10 days
after the verdict, M.R. Bell of Thirsk named his bay filly Madeleine Smith. Oh, you know those racing types. They love a sexy murderess. And fashionable young men paraded around outside the court, claiming romantic attachment to the condemned. So, she bought arsenic, and she was shagging him. And again, this is the sort of thing that a woman from a less privileged background would have hung for. Sexual impropriety was considered a sure sign of a fallen woman, a woman capable of murder. Yeah, basically the same thing. If you can put out, you can do
kill
him
somebody.
In. You do him in.
Wow.
Happily for Madeline, bad as she was, Langelier, the dandified foreign clerk and seducer, was much worse. Much like you, Sarah, your great big middle-class Victorian you, it was thought that he was trying to seduce his way up the social ladder. He was painted, the Glasgow Herald said, this is so good, that he is of French extraction, if not French by birth. The French are notoriously addicted to the use of cosmetics. See, one of the theories was that maybe he'd given himself arsenic poisoning
by trying to
whiten his complexion.
Wow.
It was understood that the French were of loose moral character. When you see French characters in books and literature and theatre of this period, you know, they're never up to any good. There was also two people were called to testify to the fact that in some districts of Lower Austria and in Styria, not near France, but, you know, not Britain, there is the custom of eating arsenic in pursuit of a healthy complexion. He was also kind of depicted as being feeble, so lacking the kind of, you know, rugged constitution of the morally upright Brit. You know, he had a history of gastric attacks. He had it coming. And he's kind of histrionic. You know, he's been rejected by women before.
He's got a poor constitution, maybe he just, like, gave up and
she
didn't
died. So much, you know, murder him as just prod him over the edge. The defence implies that he may have committed suicide. That's a very popular period at the time. And that's something that you said earlier. And you can see why, given the things he said, oh, I think she's trying to kill me, and not doing anything about it, it doesn't seem impossible.
Yeah, that he's trying to frame her for murder.
However, they didn't just go through the arsenic purchase records looking for her name. They looked for his name. He hadn't bought any arsenic. But you know who had? with witnesses.
I think Madeline Smith.
Madeline Smith. L'Angelier, basically, it's more in their interest that Madeline comes off well than he does. That's one reason why she's acquitted, because she will be. The other is just the general woeful prosecution. You know, they actually failed to prove that poison has been administered, because they don't run the right test during the autopsy. They don't present it properly in court. The letters, those many, many letters, they are undated. And they've been mixed up. They've all been put back in the wrong envelopes, so they can't actually prove.
Oh, my God.
They can't prove that they met that night. And the judge is very much on her side. When she, so she's not found not guilty.
Wait. Can we just go back to this detail? So the policeman fucked up so badly that they couldn't prove he'd taken arsenic, even though they were pretty sure he had enough arsenic to kill 40 people. The letters, which are a key piece of their evidence, they messed up and put in the wrong order.
They don't submit his diary as evidence, even though there are diary entries that literally go...
They don't put that in as evidence.
They don't. She's not found not guilty. The case is found as not proven.
Well, it doesn't sound
which
like
a brilliant...
police did their bloody job.
I mean, to be fair, maybe they didn't prove it. It's a brilliantly Scottish verdict. I don't know if they even have it down south, but it basically means, so we think you did it, don't do it again.
don't poison any of your other beers.
The defence closing, the closing speech by the defence, which was all about this sort of like, you know, filthy upstart Frenchman seducing, you know, fine young Scottish stock, received... applause. There was cheering outside the court when she was found not guilty. I think people knew she did it, but it was a victory for the middle class.
It's interesting that it's seen as a victory for the middle class, and that supersedes the fact that this is a victory for women, really. But like,
yeah, man.
what would the gender dynamics have been at the time if you take the class system out of it?
I think it's not that... I don't think this is a victory for women. I think because actually this is a victory for a moral code that isn't very kind to women. This is a refusal to... I mean, in many ways, She's locked into the role of victim, isn't she? You know, to acknowledge her as murderess would be to give her a bit of agency. Like, he's still the active figure here.
Well, could you kind of turn it around and say, so she did a really bad thing by sleeping with this guy, but she fixed the problem, so it's okay? And by fix the problem, I mean she got rid of him.
Now, I would go... I would, you know what, like, I have got a lot of time for Madeline. I think she was in a bit of a corner, really. And I think, you know, and I find it hard to forgive Emile some of the things he said. Obviously, he did not deserve to be killed for them. But, you know, I have a lot of time for Madeline, but I don't think that this was her victory in court.
No.
It wasn't a recognition of that.
Thinking how, like, the contemporary middle class would have seen it. Like, would they have seen it to... be more socially acceptable for her to be a murderess and actually have that kind of agency? Or would it have been more socially acceptable just to say she's a fallen woman, she doesn't have agency?
Absolutely the latter, which is why she wasn't charged. You know, absolutely. It was for her to be a murderess would be to acknowledge that middle-class women could do something like this. It's a real, you know, we've already had to entertain the idea that middle class men are capable of this kind of gross breach of all morality. To have a woman, a young woman, you know, be both sexually improper and violent, you know, it cannot be entertained. You know, it would seem to question the validity of their entire system, you know, this idea of their kind of innate virtue. So she did well out of that, I guess. Because there's a kind of... And I think what's sensational about this is this capacity for double think. This kind of sense, you know, everyone knows she's guilty. And we know that everyone knows she's guilty because... What was it her defence lawyer said? She's a bonny lass, but I wouldn't take supper with her.
So even her defence lawyer is basically saying, like, she totally did it.
And, you know, There's novels based on this crime afterwards. There's one called The Trial of the Serpent, 3 years after the murder, about by Mrs. Brandon, in which a character condemns the Lucrezia Borgia opera as setting a very bad example. There's a book called The Gold Worshippers by Emma Robinson in the 1860s, in which a respectably brought-up poisoner is introduced to a vile Frenchman by her vile French mistress. He blackmails her. She tries to poison him. And we see more and more female poisoners, middle-class female poisoners, appear appearing in sensation fiction after this period. In many ways, it kind of unleashed the floodgates on it. But I guess that's perhaps... One might argue that society working out its worst fantasies on the printed page because it's unable to acknowledge them in the real world.
So I've got three questions for you before we kind of...
What order are you going to ask them in?
Go. What order? Well, I'm going to answer the first, then the second, okay, then the third.
Okay, well, you are so conventional.
So you've read all of her letters, and I guess what I really want to know, because... I'm getting the strong impression you think she did it. I think you've convinced me she did it, but I want to know from what you've learned of her over the last, you know, 3 or 4 months you've been looking into this. Why do you think she did it? What was she feeling and what kind of motivated her?
Fear of ruin. Fear of ruin, because that's what it would have been. It would have been... social disgrace, it would have been marrying below her station. But also, I can't help but wonder if she must not have hated Langelier a little bit by the end. He was trying to control her. He was blackmailing her. And yes, he may have been doing it because he felt he had a right or it was a point of principle, but he was willing to ruin her, to have his way. Maybe he had it coming. Madeline's a very strong character. You know, she's very brave, she's very determined, she's very much her own woman. Whilst it would no doubt have been a conventional and social, you know, family-endorsed marriage to Minnick, at least it was a marriage she was choosing to enter into on her own terms.
Yeah.
And not one that would have left her entirely without power, within the sort of, you know, by the standards of her time.
So you think the kind of crux of this is the power dynamic and the fact that someone who is intrinsically in this relationship less powerful than her because of her social class was trying to control her and dictate her actions.
Yes.
And at the same time, she was so constrained by society because of what she'd done in the moral codes.
And I return to the fear and the desperation in what she wrote to him when he threatened to tell her father. I mean, it really is horrifying. You know, she says, "Do not make me a public shame. For God's sake, do not send my letters to Papa. It will be an open rupture. I will leave the house. I will die." She believes that. I wonder also if there might not be an element of she thought she could get away with it. Because, and let's face it, she did.
Even though
there was not much attempt at subterfuge.
Yeah.
And that's taken into account that he had all her bloody letters.
I'm just thinking, like, if she was trying to kill him to save her reputation, she went about it really shittily. Like, she didn't make sure she got the letters. She was really transparently buying arsenic.
Well, maybe then that's just to show she was not entirely in her right mind by
that's
the
true.
End. Let me read you something that I had not actually included in my notes because it was almost a bit too mad. Given light of the questions you're asking me, I think actually might shed some light on this. I think it's important to remember that although Madeline remains very much composed in court, she will not necessarily have been so at the point when she's administering or perhaps administering this poison to Emile. So at the same time as she's writing these letters begging him to spare her public shame, she writes this. She says, "I grow mad. I have been ill, very ill all day. I have had what has given me a false spirit. I had to resort to what I should not have taken, but my brain is on fire. I feel as if death indeed would be sweet."
Goodness.
She's losing her shit, mate. Yeah. She's losing her freaking shit. So, why did she do it? Desperation to avoid public ignominy, fury at being controlled, the complacent assumption that she'd get away with it, but also perhaps just a real lack of thinking anything through, just needing to bring it to an end. Maybe this was, you know, this was the at-hand solution. Obviously, it wasn't going to work. And guess what, you know, after she was not proven, William Minnick did not marry her.
Oh, unsurprising. So what did happen to her? That was going to be my second question.
Ah, well, it's rather marvellous. She, well, I'll tell you about her family first. Her parents leave Glasgow. Their reputation is ruined. Her sisters die as old maids, and one would like to think that was a choice, but one suspects that the women in the family had a bad name by that point.
What about her brothers?
Well, I suspect they escaped unscathed in that wonderful way that robust young men of the period tend to. One of them, John, conveyed her to Plymouth via London immediately after the trial. And in 1861, Madeline marries an art teacher called George Wardle. And I love the sound of this guy because he's romantic. And if we know anything about Madeline, it's that she's a bit of a romantic.
She is. So he's an art teacher.
He's an art teacher. So he's not respectable in the middle, conventional middle class way. But he's not working class either. He's bohemian. He's young, he's clever, he's intensely artistic. He's got a beard, got a broad-brimmed hat, he's got a cloak. And he likes her shady past. He thinks it's kind of sexy.
It's funny. This sounds like things have really worked out for her.
You know what? It's all come up Madeline. They move down to Bloomsbury, where she becomes a hostess, a very much a sort of bohemian society hostess. Wardle works for Morris & Co., so William Morris's company. And it is thanks to Madeline, this is so great, that we now feel comfortable eating on table mats on a bare dining table. Because, you know, there's that whole Victorian, that sort of, I mean, it's
undressed tables.
Yes, you know, Victorians didn't like to see table legs because they're too erotic. Well, the girl who wrote all that sort of voluptuous, sort of like, you know, all these voluptuous missives was the one who brought the table leg back out into the spotlight.
That's really interesting.
They have a son and a daughter. She becomes a socialist. She's the treasurer of a splinter group of socialists of the Socialist League. There is a letter mentioning her in the Marx Engels Museum in Moscow. She's also a manager of the Central Democratic Club and served coffee to George Bernard Shaw once, who frickin' loved her.
This is amazing. So this is amazing because it's like this horrific thing she's gone through, probably poisoning her, you know, turned abusive boyfriend who's blackmailing her, going through the entire public trial, being outed as a sexually voracious woman, has actually brought her a life that she really wanted.
It's liberated her. She's been freed. Because she's fallen, she's no longer confined.
That's incredible.
George Wardle leaves her in 1889 because the marriage hadn't been going well and he didn't like the look she was getting in her eyes. There's a sort of lack of certainty around what exactly happens afterwards. You know, I've read differing accounts. One thing we do know was that she looked a lot younger than she was, 20 years younger.
Wow.
She dressed aesthetically and wore a violent red wig.
Maybe arsenic is good for the skin.
Later in life, she moved to the US and she bigamously married a builder 30 years her junior. And she died aged 92 in the Bronx in New York.
Wow.
I want to take a moment just to talk about who Madeline is, because, you know, I've read a lot of her letters and I feel like I've got quite a sense now of the kind of woman she is. And she's an amazing woman. In some ways, she's very Victorian. You know, she likes the language of the time, you know, this naff little poems, you know, she claims to carry Emile's letters next to her heart. You know, it's all sweet one of my soul, my love, my all, my own best beloved, you know. And So she's kind of a sweet, romantic girl. And she's very much willingly in dominion to men. You know, there's that kind of like powerless, like she plays on her own powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
So she's very Victorian, but she's like properly a kind of like young girl, you know. So she's very dramatic. She says this, and I love this because this is just the sort of thing I would have said in my late teens, early 20s. She says, "I should be sad, miserable, and weary of this cold, unfeeling, thoughtless world. Wealth is the ruling passion. Love is a second consideration when it should be the first and the most important."
Spoken like a true romantic socialist.
Yes. She's a difficult older sister, you know? Like, she's Victorian, but she's also, yeah, she's young. What makes her not very Victorian? What makes her completely the opposite? What makes her a woman out of time? And I guess that would be my view of Madeline. If Emile was prey to all the horrible conventions of his kind, of the men of his time, she was something quite different because she believed in physical passion. She said about her deflowering in the flower garden, she said, "It is a pleasure. No one can deny that. It is but human nature. Is not everyone that loves of the same mind?"
It's beautiful.
It is. And she actually, I think, has very natural feelings towards Emile. Like, it's not all, like, weird, kinky, power-based role play. You know, when she's trying to end it with him, she says to him, you know, "I did love you. I asked you to tell me my faults. You did so, and it made me cool towards you gradually. When you have found fault with me, I have cooled." I mean, is that not entirely relatable?
Yeah.
She's got an alter ego. That's very 2019. Mimi. Oh, how I love that name of Mimi. You know, mm-hmm. That's great. I want to have a name I sign all my sexy letters by. And she's determined, you know. The logistics, again, of organising this fair are phenomenal. And she's ruthless.
She blackmailed her maid.
Yeah, she blackmailed her maid, man. I mean, that's the thing. Like, she's a blackmailer herself, isn't she?
Yeah.
One of my favourite things is that about 60 years later, when she was being interviewed about this, she kept referring to Emile as Louis. She couldn't get the name right.
Haven't we all been there?
And she actually, you know, because I guess the ultimate question, did she do it? You know, I think it's fairly clear. I think she did. And it's not just me. She actually admitted it. In 1907, H.B. Irving, son of the actor Henry Irving, met her. She was a very quiet, prim old lady, but he kind of got wind of who she was, and he asked her about it. And she said, you know, "I suppose you want to know whether I did it or not." "I did. And what's more, if it were all to happen again, I'd do it again."
My goodness. I mean, she's 92.
Yeah. No, 1907? I don't know. No, she'd be a bit younger then. She'd be what? She'd be 72.
Okay, so she's 72. Yeah. And she's saying, "Yep, I poisoned him."
My only other theory I'd go for, because I just love it, because it's so much, it's so ridiculous, is some of the people who took her part during the trial said that maybe she'd used the arsenic as a complexion enhancer, and then he'd licked it off her face and body.
So she actually just poisoned him by accident by using so much arsenic on her skin that he licked off enough to kill 40 men.
Mate, I mean, if he was a licker, again, he had it coming.
I'm imagining, like, body glitter, like, just filled with arsenic. That's sounds like something out of a James Bond film. Oh,
sounds like a warning at the back of a Just 17 magazine. That's it. That was Madeline. That was her. And I think we agree. She was a bit of a cracker.
So, I mean, we get down to the question, the last question. Demon or dame?
I will make peace with this question, but I mean, she's totally a demon, right? You know, she's a demon that makes me go, "Dame!"
Excellent. So how do we end this one?
Well, I don't know. Go have some cocoa. I'll make it.
Ash, thank you so much for telling me the story. I've had a jolly good time.
Well, what can I say? It's been my pleasure. Thank you to all who've listened and enjoyed this episode of Demons and Dames.
Bye.
Pow, 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 pow.
We sit in coffee shops and discuss the subject of plot. We speak of our men folk, then we give up.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Demons and Dames.
We will respectfully encourage you to rate us, to review us, and to recommend us to your friends.
And enemies.
It might make you like them a bit better. You can follow us on Instagram at Demons Dames Pod, on Twitter at Dames Demons.
Or you can get in touch with us via Facebook or demonsanddames@gmail.com.
Bye.
He says that he loves her, but never does anything for her that she couldn't order. So baby, come over. Come over. Sit on the sofa.
up.